Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. So Wayne and I went to see Pacific Rim yesterday.
Cool. How was it?
Not good.
Yeah, not good at all.
Oh, no, really? I was really looking forward to that.
Three words. Godzilla-sized turd.
Oh, that's harsh. That bad, huh?
Yeah, it's not like one of those, it's so bad, it's good, because you're enjoying it. As it goes along, you're just like waiting for the movie to end, and you're like, you're really dragging this out. Let's just hurry it along.
Right. Really? Like, you know what kind of like movies I like and games I like, Chris, but I actually like wanted to stand up in the theater and say, this needs more fights. Please, God, just get back to the action.
Really?
Except when it had the action, then you're like, oh, just hurry up and end this. It's just like,
well,
the kaiju shows up and you're like, oh, really? Oh, you didn't finish him off? Oh, can we just end this?
Huh.
So that we don't spoil the movie Pacific Rim, for those that actually do want to see it, we've cut out the following conversation where we discuss it, and we put it at the end of the episode after the closing song. But we also, in this discussion, we do talk about one cool aspect that can be used for a game. So if you have seen Pacific Rim, then we invite you to listen to the end. And actually, there is a link to our topic in that Pacific Rim was in Myanmar, but was released in Myanmar before it was released in Japan.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
So last month when I was in Myanmar, there was Pacific Rim. I could have watched it there.
Probably would have been cheaper too, huh?
Probably. But I didn't. But we are going to be talking about Myanmar today. So last month I went to Myanmar, and I think most people know, but for those who don't, that's the new name for Burma. And the reason why they changed the name is that Burma really only refers to one group of people. Sure, the most dominant group. I think they make up about 60% of the population. But the Burmese, but they're not the only ethnic group.
They're trying to be a bit more inclusive.
Yep, so Myanmar is a more inclusive name. We promised the rest of this episode would be more interesting than that fact.
I make no promises.
So this is going to be our next locale. So locale, Myanmar. And just like our locale for Tokyo, we've broken the episode into different sections, and we're going to be pulling out aspects that you can use when playing or when setting a game in Myanmar or a place like Myanmar. But before we get into that, we probably should give a little bit of background. Very brief. Won't get into the ancient history, but at least into the 20th century, you have the British were in Burma. And some people wanted independence from Britain. So when the Japanese came in, they sided, or were approaching Burma, they sided with them. Then when the Japanese won and took over, they realized, whoa, not so good for us. So they joined the resistance and then sided with Britain again and the United States to force out the Japanese. Then after the war, Burma got its independence. And then there was a really chaotic time. And during that chaotic time, the leader of Burma gave power to a general and said that he could kind of like run the country for a certain period of time, like as an emergency. And that short period of time became most of the 20th century. And only recently, within the last few years, has the country started to open up, and the military junta allowed elections a couple years ago.
Yeah, I read into the history, because obviously Chris and I didn't go to Burma, so, you know, we had to do research about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was slightly difficult to follow the history during World War II, because it seemed like, yeah, Burma changed sides. Well, I guess it was only technically twice, but it seemed like, you know, different factions within the country were either part of the Japanese or the Allied army at various times, and well, I guess part of the reason why it was such a chaotic place after World War II is that Burma pretty much got destroyed during the war between the Japanese and, you know, the Allied troops. The numbers they put in, the like, casualties were pretty astounding. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of see why you would have to, or why it would seem like a good idea to hand the country over to military rule just to kind of get back on your feet and to make sure stuff gets done and things get rebuilt. So, mm-hmm.
Well, there's also rioting at the time and lots of different kinds of religious problems.
Yeah.
Too. So, yeah, you're right. It didn't make sense to do it. It just kind of went the same way as the Galactic Empire.
Yeah. You know what? You know what? This is going to sound crass, but I bet what happened in Burma was a lot less boring than what happened in episodes 2 and 3.
Unlimited power!
during the military junta, there were sanctions, so the country was effectively cut off.
Right.
Myanmar is surrounded by, it borders, like, India, Thailand, and China. Those would be the main ones. Mm-hmm. So those three countries have had a very strong influence on it. And even now, though, that even though the country's opened up and it's got democracy, about 25% of the seats in their parliament is reserved for the military.
Mm-hmm.
To change the constitution, you need 75% plus one.
Right.
To make a constitutional change, so as you can see, they've effectively blocked that.
Mm-hmm. Unless you can get that one military guy to sign it.
Yeah. They rotate the military, the rumor is, every 6 months.
Wow.
So the officers that serve in the parliament only serve for about 6 months, and that is so that they don't develop allegiance outside of the military. So the military is still very much a separate entity.
That seems to be pretty much, if not in control, having a chokehold on the rest of the government.
No, they're in control.
Okay.
But Burma is also known as a land with a lot of natural resources and wealth. It's near Thailand, so you can imagine what the weather would be like.
Landscapes are beautiful, too, hey?
Oh, yeah, it has beautiful temples. It's a very religious country, religion being Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
They also do have Christians and Muslims as well. And I'm sure other religions, but the primary one is Buddhist, and it's very much a Buddhist country.
Yeah, it's very Thai-styled Buddhism, too, in that they have, you're talking about the temples, they have a lot of the giant golden Buddhas and gold-wrapped temples and stuff. Very, very different than the kind of Buddhism we see here in Japan.
Hmm. Something that I didn't know, they have a virtual monopoly on jade, rubies, and teak.
Mm-hmm.
So
I knew that because you mentioned it last week.
And they have, the second largest producer of opium. But that only amounts to about 10% because Afghanistan produces so much.
Hmm. So the second, but a distant second.
Yeah. Oh, but it's illegal there too.
Just to make that clear.
So like the Topio episode, we have four categories, and they are people, power, culture, and landscape. So since we are talking a lot about the military junta, I think it's probably be appropriate to start with power.
Yeah, sure.
So what's one aspect or some aspects that we could use for Myanmar?
Well, one of the big aspects then is corruption.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's the level of corruption is pretty amazing, in that how effectively the military was able to cripple the country. And, I mean, you can say the more traditional things is, we talked about the rubies and jade and that, and, they take a massive cut of that trade.
Mm-hmm.
But also, they crippled the education system. So they reduced the number of years you need to graduate from what we would consider high school by 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So what that's done is it's limited the international university that students can go to because they're 1 year short of the requirement, or 1 or 2 years short. And they've reduced the undergraduate degrees by a year or two. So if somebody wanted to do like a graduate degree, they're now looking at like 1, 2, 3 years shy of what they need to be eligible to apply for these graduate degrees in other countries. Mm-hmm. Wow. And it's just like very clever, but very...
destructive?
Very destructive, very evil, very insidious, yeah.
I don't think anybody's really looking at the Juanta and saying, hey, those were a bunch of great guys.
Yeah, but I think it's when you actually, I mean, when you develop your role-playing game, government, dictatorship, there's things that you do, and you borrow from the best, if you will, the worst. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at what the Nazis did, and you say, well, okay, they had the Hitler Youth, and so we'll have camps, and we'll do that, and that's how they establish control. But then you look at some more subtle things done, you know, in actual countries, and you look at what happened in Myanmar. So they're able to cripple everything by making these slight changes. Because people were protesting, there were a lot of student protests within the city of Yangon. They moved all the universities outside of Yangon.
Did they, like, split them up?
Well, they moved them outside so that students actually would have to move out of the house in order to attend university, and many were not wealthy enough to do that.
That's so insidiously brilliant.
Yeah.
Wow.
They built a brand new capital city about 10 years ago, and we were lucky enough to be able to visit it, because it was actually closed to foreigners until a year or two ago. And there's nothing there. They built it from scratch. And one of the theories as to why they built it is that if there are any protests or civil unrest, they can close the highways and then cut off the government from the other cities. But if the government was actually in Yangon, they can't separate themselves from the rest of the people, because Yangon's like the major city.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Having said that about the, you know, the corruption and the oppression, there isn't a military presence the way there is in other countries, and certainly not in the way that I would have expected. Like, we didn't see any soldiers until we went to the capital and actually saw them in the parliament building.
We mentioned corruption as being rampant. Did you see anything of that, or for that matter, of that kind of military overdrive? Obviously not the military, because you mentioned it now, but how about the corruption?
I mean, we didn't see it because we don't see any business going on. But yeah, no, it's a good question, because certain things that do come up is that all business is done in cash, and that I think that all business. Because the banking industry is almost non-existent. They're going to have a stock market in 2015, maybe next year. That they just started to float the currency.
Wow!
But like, we were at an elevator company, and the company's a European company. It's pretty famous, Schindler Elevators, and even when people are buying elevators and getting the installation and that, they pay for that in cash.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah, and we were talking to the managing director there, and he was laughing about it, and he's, yeah, that's what we do. And, I mean, there's things that you have to, it's all about your relationships. And he said he doesn't bid for military contracts because of all the stuff involved, but you kind of have to bid. So you put in a token thing, even though he doesn't want to, and he just will refuse to make the bid competitive.
Interesting. Well,
what do you just mean, so like, you have to bid? Is it because, like, if you don't bid, you look suspicious?
No, not, I don't know, not really suspicious. You kind of be involved because you don't want to burn any bridges.
Right, okay.
But he doesn't want to accept any contracts. And they're really open about, you know, how corrupt things are, and that's just the way of doing business is bribery, and I suppose I should probably give a little bit of background. We were in Myanmar because of an MBA trip.
Right.
So we were had access that, you know, the average tourist might not have been able to get, because one of our classmates in Montreal, he's from a very wealthy and influential Myanmar family. So he was able to set up a lot of meetings with business people and government officials that, you know, a tourist wouldn't be able to meet. So we were talking to one business guy, and he's and he's from Japan, and he's from a Japanese trading company, and he was talking about how when they built this capital city, how corrupt the process was, and the bidding process. Then we actually met a company who was involved in building it, and they were talking about, yeah, we got to build up so much, but we already knew that in order for them to do that, they had to like do a lot of bribing. But it's so open. I mean, they're really open about a lot of stuff, and laughing and joking about it. During the sanctions, the Chinese really took advantage of them, and now they hate the Chinese. So. But they don't hide that. They're just telling anybody that they don't like the Chinese and they're really not happy with all these agreements that they made with them because they were at a disadvantage and, you know, just telling just random students.
Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah. But that's an important thing about the corruption is just how open they are or how open it is. So while we didn't see the military in the street, if you go in the parliament, they got their section, they're all wearing their green uniforms, and you're like, there you go, visible. It's not like they're trying to hide that they're controlling things behind the scenes. So that's something, if you're going to set the game there, is that, I mean, you play it up all you want, but you won't see certain things, but people talk about it. People talk about the self-censorship, or people talk about the bribery and the things that you need to do, because that's just the way of doing business, and that's the way we do things now.
Yeah, I think that's a great aspect that you can pull into games, because we're so used to, in our culture, kind of that being the secret level. You know, when you bribe somebody, you pass it underneath the table. It'd be a really interesting and completely different, at least for me, way of doing it, where the bribe is there. You know, you're making the contract with somebody, and they look at you straight in the face and say, all right, where's my cut?
Yeah, I was thinking, like, again, not to, you know, belittle the actual condition in Myanmar. But how many times in a fantasy game have you seen the city run by the Thieves Guild, you know, or even in science fiction settings, you know, the habitat or whatever controlled by a cartel, and you don't really get the sense of all that bribery and corruption out in the open, but it would be. Especially if you have that Thieves Guild run city, or you know how the City of Thieves, or all that stuff. And I think Myanmar would be a good example to base that setting on, where everything is just completely out in the open. And as you said, Chris, instead of, you know, slipping the bribe, you know, in an envelope, you know, that's very inconspicuous. It's just like right there, you know, out on the street, handing money. Yep. Oh, hey, but yep, right there.
Yeah, there's so many places in the world where, you know, you can pass a $100 bill and that'll bribe off, you know, whatever, a cop or something like that, if you're in some kind of trouble. And it's kind of, the name for that is the unspoken rule that you can pay off the police in certain places. But in this place, it's a spoken rule.
Yeah. Like,
the cops might negotiate for how much they get.
Yeah, we didn't see a whole lot of police.
Right, sorry, that's a speculation on my part. Sorry.
No, I'm just... Just something also to point out. We didn't see a lot of police. We saw one guy. He was relaxing. That would be a kind word. and then we passed another police car once, and they were just sleeping in the car. I don't know what they were doing. The cars were really run down. You sense that they don't spend a lot of money on their police force.
Well,
there's not much point.
Again, kind of like asking, you know, question time with Lyle. Is the police actually part of the military? Because, like, if it is, then I would imagine that to be, you know, somewhat better kept. And if they aren't, well, then they're kind of extraneous a little bit.
Or is it a face on top of the military for civilian?
Yeah.
They didn't look like they were getting military funding just based on the condition.
Right.
But, I mean, that amount of laziness, they must be insulated somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So... they seem to be the, you know, the police officer that is annoyed when they have to
do something
and call the disturbance, so that kind of settles things down, because you don't know which way the police officer is going to go. because they're just annoyed with everybody involved in the situation because you've made them get out of the car, and they're in the middle of a nap. So that would be something to play up. And I didn't have any altercations with police officers, so I'm just making that up.
Yeah, just want to put that out front.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're saying all these terrible things about the corruption and the oppression and such, but this brings up kind of one of the nicer points that you mentioned earlier, Laos, that people are generally well-behaved. That's a very safe place to be.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Chris. So we should move on to people then. And one of them is, yeah, like you said, it's remarkably safe.
You don't often think of that in such a corrupt culture. It kind of seems to me like, you know, if you didn't give somebody the bribe, well, then you're going to get drug out back and have your legs broken, kind of thing. But that doesn't really seem to be the case. If you're saying people are, well, again, we're talking like the average citizen, if they're so polite.
Well, you know, sorry to disagree with you on that, but I do. I think the more corrupt places they are, at least when the government is officially corrupt, I find the places to be generally safer. Because if the government is engaging in these shakedown kinds of crimes and taking money from people, they don't want the competition of petty criminals.
That's true.
It's very safe, and maybe that's not a very sexy thing to have, but it allows characters to go into really seedy and traditionally dangerous environments without power armor or things like that. I mean, we went to one place late at night, three of us, and you pull up and you're in a taxi and you know, it looks like you've pulled up into a ghetto. But it turns out there's like a nightclub in one of these buildings. But it looks like the building was condemned about 10, 20 years ago. And there's like wild dogs everywhere, stray dogs everywhere in the city of Yangon. But they don't attack anybody. They don't even bark or anything at you. But you have all these like dangerous elements around you, or what should be dangerous, but it's not. So you're kind of like floating through, or kind of going through the sea of danger, but feeling very safe. You go into this tiny elevator packed with total strangers and nobody's accosting you, or you're not even worried about pickpockets. Then you go to a place where like just crazy stuff is happening, and then you're like, well, yeah, I'm just going to go back to the hotel, and you leave by yourself and you're not worried. So there is that, but I mean, in a game you might want to make it dangerous, but you certainly don't have to in this.
Well, I don't know. I kind of think that would be an interesting juxtaposition because, let's face it, most games are about dangerous situations because situations that aren't dangerous are kind of boring, and nobody wants to play those. So even kind of regular cities or regular locations will have their bad sections. And I think it would be really interesting just as setting backdrop. I don't really know what you would do with it. But then to have this, as we keep saying, pretty corrupt and seemingly dangerous place that is actually not.
Yeah, I think you nailed it right there with the word juxtaposition, in that in a place like that, the cleaner and quote-unquote nicer place you go, that's actually the more dangerous of the place, because that's where the real criminals of the society are, the people who will fleece you down for money.
Or you can make it where the... No, that's a great idea, and you can make it where they want everybody to believe things are safe.
Right.
So like Chris was touching on earlier, like about all the petty crime, and it's not even a government thing, it's just because such horrific things are happening.
Yeah.
That why bother with the pickpocketing or the other things? Or they could be, I mean, that's all, it's almost like a double mask. It looks dangerous, but it's safe because it actually is very, very dangerous.
Yeah. Wow. That's deep.
Or something else is happening, or it also allows them to deny, like if you have some sort of supernatural game going on and you're like, well, I just saw this guy get killed, and you're like, what guy? We don't see anything. Nah, you know how many murders we've had in Yangon? You know, 5. So I don't think you saw that.
And then,
well, maybe I didn't see it. I don't know.
Or like, and if that trick. And if that
because everything looks so dangerous, but really nothing's happened to me. And he's like, well, you're traveling. Well, I'll say this, but you know, you're traveling by yourself, white man. Like, and nothing's happening to you. And you're like, yeah, you actually are right.
Yeah.
And I've met a woman, a French woman, and she traveled with her female friend, and it was fine.
Wow.
Nothing bad happened to him. Just imagine, like, I mean, traveling around France by yourself.
Traveling anywhere, pretty much, by yourself.
But especially France. So. Yeah, and it's also like that small town where everybody's really friendly to you, but why should they be?
Mm.
And that's great, and everybody was really friendly to you, and maybe part of it is because
they were expecting a bribe.
They can probably make more money off of you being friendly, but also there's a Buddhist culture where they're just perhaps naturally trying to be kind. But what you could play it a little bit darker, and what's that hiding?
Hmm.
I think you mentioned that before the cast, though, that friendliness is really kind of just a mask because the culture is really cliquey.
Yeah, no, and that it is very cliquey, and it's very diverse. Now, first, and we touched on that in the beginning when we said why they changed the name from Burma to Myanmar, because there's so many different ethnicities, something like 140. And then there's some different religions. So what you found out, and one of our professors described it as a different types of mafia, and it just these cliques, and we're talking to this one guy, and he's talking about, normally you have two connections, such as your ethnicity and your religion, but sometimes you'll have only one connection. He was talking about his sister's business, and he was not necessarily surprised, but saying it was unusual that she hired a guy, and there was only one connection, and I believe that was the ethnicity, not the religion. And that's the way it is. So the military becomes a clique, and they have that connection. But then you have all these other power people who oppose the military. Mm-hmm. And you can see them as, oh, you know, that's so noble, you're opposing the military. And you're like, hold on, how did you keep all your money opposing the military when they're in complete charge? And you're like, ah, you have power, and you have this clique. And how do you define yourself? And it's like, ah, by your ethnicity and by your religion. And some of the major ethnicities, they have pretty distinctive features. Hmm. The more Burmese people, very tall and slim, or taller, slimmer. Then you have more stockier people towards the south, and you can kind of see that. But also, it's very hard when you go to Myanmar to pick out like a typical Myanmar person.
Hmm.
I mean, sure, the black hair, but after that, I mean, you can have very pale skin, very dark skin, very squat, very, very lithe. Hmm. But then, if you want to, like, make it, or if you want to simplify it a bit, you can say, okay, maybe I can see some connections here and try to spot the cliques.
Hmm.
You know, okay, they're Buddhist, oh, they're Christian. I mean, and you might want to go for the minorities because Christians, they're not as many of them, so that might make their bonds a little bit tighter.
Right.
Yeah. Though we have slim Christians and stocky Christians. I wonder if they're connected or are they all separate?
Hmm. That's kind of, again, it's, well, not necessarily a good thing in reality, but if you take it into a game, then I kind of like that two or three connections rule, especially for like a party of PCs. It's like, great. It's kind of the typical, you know, again, I always kind of default to fantasy because I think everybody does. But, you know, the typical party of adventurers is this eclectic mix of whatever race, religion, and whatever that people want to play. And it's often a struggle to come up with why the party is together. But if you kind of have that, like, two-point connection rule, you might have to, like, enforce it, or if you were upfront about it right from the beginning, I like how strong a party it would make. You'd be like, great, okay, you have to have at least two connections with everyone else in the group, or you have to kind of, like, share two characteristics, whether that's going to be race, religion, culture or whatever.
I was thinking for social encounters in this kind of society, it would work really well because, you know, normally you have the face of the group and he's the person who takes the majority of the social interactions for everyone. But if you had this kind of society where you required a connection, and if the characters in the party had these different kinds of connections, ethnicity or religion, then the face might not be the right person to talk to certain groups of people, you know? He doesn't have any connections with this this mafia boss, so he's, even though he's the best talker, he's not the person who should be talking.
Right.
The person who's the same ethnicity, they should take the lead, even if they're not so comfortable with it. It would be interesting to, you would have to share around the social aspect of the game.
I like how that would divide that role up in a group. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in a game. Again, not in real life. It's kind of not that great, obviously. But, again, I think this is something that often gets glossed over in games of prejudice. You know, and kind of refusing to interact with certain people or, you know, interacting negatively with certain people just because of those ethnicity or religious tags. And I like what, or I like the idea you came up with, Chris, and how it kind of shares that role among the party. But I think for it to work, you would have to be in a setting similar to Myanmar where everyone around you is going to react negatively or at best maybe indifferently to you if you don't have those connections.
You know, that's a really great way to kind of maybe introduce that theme of prejudice into your game, because the lines are so clear cut. You know, it's not just somebody who's who's just a jerk and he doesn't like your character.
Right.
But, you know, if he's a different religion, then he's got a reason to be prejudiced against you. So it'd be kind of a quote unquote safe way of introducing it in, because it's not, you don't have to worry about your own preferences. It's pretty black and white as why a person might be acting that way.
Right, and you don't even kind of have to do it, well, I mean, of course it's going to be negative, but you don't really have to be mean about it. Like, the person doesn't have to hate people of a different religion. It's just, no, sorry, we don't really interact with you, or it's very minimal interaction, or you're not going to get the deals that we would normally offer an insider. So,
again, yeah, perfect, especially with a place that has corruption like that. You don't have to be mean to the person. You can just deny, not take his bribe, and that means your business doesn't go.
Right.
No, it's good. Some good ideas. I was also thinking you do like six, you know, was it 6 degrees of separation?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows you to track people down and not necessarily through the channels you might normally. So you meet a Christian because you want to meet somebody else as a Christian.
Right, right.
And then... or you can meet the ethnicity and you kind of like link up and try to find somebody through that way. So it allows you to track people down through religions, ethnicities, and other connections.
Yeah, it's not just a matter of finding your quarry, but finding out how to get to your quarry.
Yeah, maybe this came up in Tokyo, but I think we had mentioned something about like a detective game where you could do so many different subgroups because there's so many kind of, you know, otaku culture subgroups in Tokyo, and this kind of seems like the same thing, just on like, you know, ethnic and religious scale. And you said, okay, we're trying to locate this person, they're this religion and this ethnicity, which means we're going to have to go through these channels and deal with these groups that we wouldn't normally deal with. And that would be a great way for the GM to either have other party members or other players in the group act as the face characters because they match the ethnicity and or religious, you know, makeup of the group they need to talk to. Mm-hmm. And it's also a great way for the GM to showcase the diversity in this one place because you're going to have to deal with all these different groups, and it's not just kind of, you know, you're not going to be able to take that one step or just that one degree of separation to get to the person you're, or thing you're trying to find.
Totally, yeah.
All right, next up is culture. Oh, weren't we going to say the people are cheap?
I think you were going to say the people are cheap.
I'm not going to say it.
And the next aspect for the people, and this is not very flattering, is cheap. And, like, everything's cheap there, and except for hotels. Hotels are about the same price as you'd pay in Tokyo.
Dang.
Yeah. Because most of them are controlled by the government.
Hmm.
And that really means the military. But, I mean, one thing, and it's rather benign, but you would instead of buying a tour or a tour guide, you just buy like a guy in a car and rent him out for a week for like really cheap.
I've got a buddy who goes to Thailand all the time, and he says that's what how he does it. He just looks for a guy hanging out outside the airport, gives him $50, and gets a tour.
Yep, and that's what you do in Myanmar as well. I mean, we met a guy in the big market in Yangon. It's their largest market, and you know, he's trying to sell these, asking us if we wanted what we wanted. Like he didn't have anything on him to sell, so we were like, well, we're looking for these skirts, so he takes us to this place, so obviously he was going to get a cut. Mm-hmm. But anywhere we wanted to go, he would take us and get a cut, or we'd pay him directly.
You know, this is off topic, Lab, but I saw your Facebook picture with the skirt. It was a pretty interesting picture.
Yeah, I bought three of those.
It's so weird because, you know, for the audience, Lyle is generally a very well-dressed guy, more on the formal side. So it's waist up. You were wearing like your regular overshirt and stuff. Very formal. Waist down, skirt and sandals. It was an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, we were told that we wouldn't be able to wear shorts when we went there. So the plan was to buy these skirts called longis.
Okay.
Yeah. So we did. And they were reasonably comfortable. The problem is first skirt, but you have to like tie them up, and there's a little bit of a trick to that for them to stay up, so they kept coming down. I kept untying.
Oops, my skirt fell off again, ladies.
How inopportune or opportune. So, but I mean, that kind of a real dark side of, like, you know, people are cheap, so you would catch a taxi and the guy would offer you like, I was in the taxi for 5-10 minute ride, and I got offered. The guy kept persisting. Do you want somebody for what would be the equivalent of, I believe, $30?
Well, what do you mean, to show you around?
No.
Yeah, in a sense.
I wanted a companion for the night for $30, and I said, no, thanks. I just want to go back to my hotel. And he's like, are you sure?
Because I have someone who can go back to the hotel with you for $30.
Yeah, and it was, you know, on the one hand, no, don't do it at all, because it is illegal there, but it's very open. And on the other hand, do you really want to, like, trust some taxi driver to, like, make the choice for you? And you're like, well, here it is. And he'd be like, oh, I paid $30 for that? All right. Yeah, one of our classmates, it's a woman, was talking to this guy and talking to this girl, and we kind of knew what kind of girl she was,
right,
in this club. And I was like, oh, why are you talking to him? And she's like, well, oh, I was talking to him and his sister. And I'm like, his sister? She's like, yeah. And I didn't know it's not what the relationship is. Mm-hmm. She's like, no, he said it was a sister. All right. So then I walked over and then spoke to him for a bit and then walked back, and I said, okay, for $40 I could have his sister. So not his sister.
Maybe it was.
Yeah, it could have been his sister. Who knows?
Yeah, and then we in one place, and then there was like a fashion show that could have, but it wasn't really a fashion show.
Oh, yeah.
The clothes weren't for sale.
Or they were, they just came with the girl.
Yeah, well, I don't think the guys kept the clothes. So, but it was like really open, even though it was very illegal.
So. Go back to that whole corruption thing.
Much like Japan, actually. Like, Japan is very similar thing, so people are familiar with the way Japan does that kind of trade. Then, you have a good indication of what happens. And I imagine Thailand would be the same, but I've only been to the airport.
It is. It is.
Whoa, even the airport was insane.
So, there's that. So next up is so next up would be culture, but I think we've touched on a lot of things, and the episode's already running a bit long. Mm-hmm. And we touched on most of the things. Yeah, diverse, cheap culture. But it is very spiritual, so there are a lot of cool temples. But I suppose that's more in landscape. So one thing in landscape, everything is broken down and falling apart.
And the new stuff?
Even the new stuff, even in that, that 10-year-old city, which we stayed in what they called a 5-star hotel, and it was already falling apart.
Wow.
And you would wonder if it was actually ever built properly. And there's a debate. And we talked about the education system. They have a very unskilled labor force because they don't have the education anymore to train up enough artisans and craftsmen and construction workers. So you have that working against it. And then you also have just the corruption. So all the, you know, you pay $1 million and like $500,000 is maybe skimmed off. And, well, it's not really a skim.
Yeah, like, I was just thinking, too. That's like a garbage.
Cut off, yeah. So you take that massive corruption and the unskilled labor force and you have a city that can't even really, or a country that can't, struggles to repair itself. And we're talking about roads with like huge pits dug out of it, like no real sidewalks. You're walking on dirt and dodging holes. Everything's falling apart, even new things. We were in that 10-year-old city, and during one dinner, there was three blackouts because there's a huge problem with power. And we were there during the rainy season, which is the best time for power because you get the most hydroelectricity. And people were saying if you come in the dry season, it's drier, but there's less power. And we're talking about in the main cities, the new capital and the old capital. So they would be the most.
What percentage of your time was spent without power?
In the old capital, Yangon, it wasn't that bad, actually. But, I mean, we walked out once and there's a complete blackout on one side of the street.
Wow.
Like everything. And in the old, the new capital, Naypyidaw, it was a more frequent occurrence. For whatever reason, even though they kind of, you know, like how Las Vegas would be really lavish with the water, just kind of
give
show
that
they were able to do it.
Yeah.
And they were kind of really lavish with the power, like the lights where they don't need to be lights. And which in a place like Tokyo, you don't think twice about, but in a place where you know that they have a power shortage, you're kind of, why have you strung up all those lights there? And then, okay, well, you shouldn't have.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, because, like, yeah, a place like Las Vegas, you would say, okay, they're doing all this to put on the illusion of prosperity or, you know, glitz and all this stuff, but it never really seems to go down, like the illusion is permanent, where, okay, I can see that working and that impressing people, but if the illusion isn't permanent, you know, if it's kind of really temporary like that, I can go down at any second, like you said. Well, then, yeah, is it really worth it?
Yeah, I mean, and you also wonder, just because it runs so high, this deterioration, this decay. I mean, throwing out different words for the same aspect is so prevalent. I mean, we were in this building with a company that's a rising star in Myanmar, and they like snapped up all those government contracts to build the new capital, and they were branding rice and they were doing all these things, and they built this hospital that Obama would have stayed in if he had an emergency in Myanmar. And the building was falling apart. They are in the construction business. Their own office building was falling apart. Their own office building was so unsophisticated and decayed, like it would just shock you. Like there was garbage in the corridor. And then, like, he very kindly, yeah, I'm not trying to be too negative, but very kindly took us up to the penthouse so that we could get a view of Yangon. And, like, which we hadn't seen from that perspective before. And the penthouse was big, it had a lot of space, and it was just really poorly made, even though you could tell that this was an expensive place for there. And apartments are very expensive, so it's not as if that's cheap. So this place probably costs a lot, and it was just, it would be like something in Japan that was built in the 80s and never kept up.
Wow.
So, and even though they built it probably a few years ago.
It's the same story I hear from my buddy who goes to North Korea too, that all the materials there and the building style is so cheap that, you know, you break your shade just by closing them. So same deal.
Yeah.
Which is weird because, you know, this is quite different than the idea I got from looking at some of the landmarks in Myanmar. everything that I saw was incredibly lavish. I think most of the pictures I saw were by tourists or for tourists.
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. Most of them were these huge temples, you know, just completely wrapped in gold, extreme expense. There's this one, I'm looking at it now on Wikipedia, the Kyaiktio Pagoda, which is this enormous boulder, 24 feet tall. I mean, it's literally the size of a house, and it's been completely wrapped in gold leaf.
Oh, I mean, yeah, they don't spare, when it comes to the temples, they don't spare on the gold and the rubies and the diamonds.
Yeah.
So the temple we went to, which is like the number one holy place in all of Myanmar, the Shwe Dagon Pagoda.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we were there, and it is really lavish, and I can't say that that necessarily looked any more deteriorated than a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
But that was certainly not the norm. Hmm. And we didn't get right into the upper echelons in power. We were looking at reasonably successful businesses and successful foreign businesses. But when people, you know, try to play these, you know, or present these wealthy businessmen, they shouldn't make the background too lavish.
Mm-hmm.
It should still have an aura of decay that it is crumbling around them. And it kind of gets this country is really energized because they are opening up. So which is another aspect. It's like opening up. So it has a lot of energy, but it's like everything is falling apart, but they quickly want to rebuild it and kind of have that. It's like everything is changing, but everything's staying the same. So, I mean, there's a lot you can do with that.
Hmm. Well, apart from the decay thing. Well, I guess that could factor in there too, because you're bringing up sort of like decay and the fact that everything's falling apart. Yeah, I thought about like those temples, and they might look great, but they've got to be ancient, and you know, just because they're so old, they're probably falling apart. But
well, the Shwe Dagon Pagoda is about 2,000 years old.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So I don't know, the fact that Myanmar is now, you know, kind of opening again to outside influence. And again, thinking fantasy made me think of the typical fantasy race that closed themselves off from humanity for whatever reason. And you think of the elves and dwarves are the typical, you know, ones. And
oh, kind of like the first race in so many sci-fi genres.
Yeah, exactly. You know, or the group that always, you know, enforces sort of the isolation policy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, that's ends our episode on locales, Myanmar, which, if you're looking at setting something in a Southeast Asian country, certainly consider that, because it's, some people have described it as sort of like the Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that, yeah.
Southeast Asia.
The Wild Wild Southeast.
So, yeah, yeah.
Or if you wanted to like take aspects and just add it to your science fiction or fantasy game, that would also be pretty good. I mean, certainly, you can't go wrong. And of course, if you'd like to listen to us talk more about Pacific Rim, please stay until the end of the closing song. We do, as we said before...
God have mercy on your soul.
All right. So, again, we're not very kind. But we also do talk about one part of the movie that you could use in your game that we thought was actually pretty cool.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or you can stream it through Stitcher or iTunes, or download it through DriveThruRPG. You can also follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook, or send us an email to tell us how much you like us, because we love hearing that. Or, you know, just comments about the show, because we love getting those too. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.
So Wayne and I went to see Pacific Rim yesterday.
Cool. How was it?
Not good.
Yeah, not good at all.
Oh, no, really? I was really looking forward to that.
Three words. Godzilla-sized turd.
Oh, that's harsh. That bad, huh?
Yeah, it's not like one of those, it's so bad, it's good, because you're enjoying it. As it goes along, you're just like waiting for the movie to end, and you're like, you are really dragging this out. Let's just hurry it along.
Right. Really? Like, you know what kind of like movies I like and games I like, Chris, but I actually like wanted to stand up in the theater and say, this needs more fights. Please, God, just get back to the action.
Really?
Except when it had the action, then you're like, oh, just hurry up and end this. It's just like, well, the kaiju shows up and you're like, oh, really? Oh, you didn't finish him off? Oh, can we just end this?
Huh.
You know how, like, every movie they have something that, you know, it fails?
Mm-hmm.
So the hero's got to go do something.
Right,
to,
right.
You know, to fix it. You know, like some jury rigging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're just like, we don't need five more minutes of this movie. Just we know what's going to happen. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and it just stuff didn't make sense. I know. Giant robots fighting giant monsters.
But you
accept. You don't care. Where did they come from? Don't care. How did they build these giant robots? Don't care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
They do that in the first like 5 minutes or 10 minutes. They explain. Oh, and then we just kind of built them.
That was
because everybody came together. We just built them. You're like, cool, great.
That was the one good part of the movie. It started off good. The beginning started off good, and I said this about like Prometheus 2. The pacing at the beginning of the movie to get you where the story needs to start, excellent. You're just like, yeah, bam, bam, this happened, this happened. As Lyle said, you know, we came together, we built these things, and we started fighting back, and then you're just like, great. Mm-hmm. Just kick into the story.
I mean, they built, okay, this is a spoiler alert. But for those people that have,
I think everybody else has seen the movie since we're like the last country to get it.
Honestly, I haven't seen it. Don't watch it. There's a big spoiler. It sucks. at the end of the movie, it sucks. But at the beginning, it sucks too. So. But they've got these giant robots and they're fighting these giant monsters, right? Okay, that's the premise. And then the giant robots called the Jaegers, they start to lose some battles. So the solution is to stop the program and build walls along the coast, but not build walls and put weapons on the walls or something. No, just build big walls, and then the kaiju just kind of like crush through the walls because they crush through everything. They crush through whole buildings, but
for some reason they thought a wall would stop them.
Yeah, and it's just, well, why don't you take all these weapons that can obviously kill them and put them on the walls? But that's not the dumb thing. They actually, all of the kaijus come through one, relatively speaking, small hole. And they know where it is. But they have all of these bases around on the coasts, so when they attack, but it starts off like only one kaiju comes through the hole at a time, and you've got about 30 of these Jaegers all in different bases, when you're like, why don't you put them all around the hole?
Yeah.
And then every time a kaiju starts to come in, kill it! And then if you're like, okay, they're not working, let's build a wall. Build a wall around the hole. Actually, build a whole dome around the hole and bombs or whatever. Just, and every time they come up, just blow them up or just stop them or shoot them. But they don't
do
that. They're,
I know,
just
when
like,
you said that, it's like, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Because they're like, first they're like, they came through this thing and you're imagining, oh, it must be like the entire Pacific Ocean that they're coming through. No, it's a tiny hole.
Relatively
like,
speaking,
you know,
yeah, just like one point. Where they
it
come
fit
from?
Like a
we
few
know.
Of these monsters at the same time, but it's not that big. And they had about 30 of these Jaegers. I mean, you could have put 6 around the hole in shifts, you know, 5 shifts a day, and they just stand there all day, and they just—I mean, one of these things comes up, kill it. 2 of them come up, kill them both. I mean, it wouldn't be very dramatic, but that's what you would do. It's just that kind of. I mean, yeah, there's. Spending your disbelief and just like, oh, come on. And then it's like, we only have 4 left. I'm like, oh, really? And then they do the classic, let's pump these guys up. And it goes, oh, these Chinese triplets, they've got this many kills. And these Russians for 6 years stopped the kaiju from
The wall was unbreached. And then they do the, what I'll call like the reverse ninja effect. You know about the ninja effect, Chris, where it's like the more bad guys you have in one scene, the less competent they are because, you know, you have to disperse the ninja power among all of them.
Of course, yeah.
But, yeah, there's the one guy and he kicks, you know, kicks the guy's ass because it's all that power concentrated in one guy. So they pulled the reverse here. Yeah, they pumped up this Russian team and this Chinese team, you know, the last two teams, and then the only time we see them fight, they get destroyed. I mean, absolutely destroyed. And you're like, hold on. How did these guys get, like, 10 confirmed kills? How did these guys keep the wall safe for, like, 6 years? What, were they all, like, tiny little kaiju that did absolutely nothing? Because, man, they got their butts handed to them. So then, of course, you know, the American team and the Australians, who we apparently like because they didn't get killed, come in and save the day. And you're like, you guys only did that to show how badass, apparently, these kaiju are, so that will feel good when the American team beats them. But no, they just kind of did nothing. So, yeah, it was just...
No, and Wayne brought up, like, I was saying, you know, they're kind of just waiting in, like, knee-deep water, knee-deep for these giant robots.
Oh, yeah.
And Wayne's like, yeah, so how did these kaiju, like, sneak up and, like, jump out of the water? Like...
It's essentially like fighting something in the kiddie pool. You're like, oh, it's submerged. Yeah. Where'd it go? Oh, it's right there, dude. Can't you see it? You know?
Yeah, you
but no, it's like,
where'd
it go? Where'd it go? And then, of course, you know, it burst out of the water. And you're like, wait, how did a skyscraper-sized thing hide in knee-deep water? I don't know.
It's kind of like my daughter. She covers her face and considers herself invisible to the world.
Maybe that's what they did. Oh, systems are offline. Where'd it go? I don't know.
Yeah, they should have had that instead of the wall, just a blanket. We're issuing a blanket to all our citizens. We're going to put it over our face. And it goes, and you, the audience, could have a blanket, too. And you're like, thank you.
Yeah.
But what's a shame is that the special effects are pretty good, and the production design, again, was good.
Yeah.
They had some – they came up with some – by some, maybe I mean one. But one clever thing is – where they kind of explain why you have two pilots, or they don't kind of explain it. They explain why they have two pilots per robot, and you're like, okay, you know, that's good enough
that's
reason.
That's cool.
And that can actually, you can work with it, because, you know, they share memories, and you're like, all right, well, that creates, could possibly create some interesting dynamics. Mm-hmm. Except later in the movie, it's called Drift, and there has to be some sort of compatibility between the two pilots.
Except there doesn't.
Well, except there doesn't at the end when it's convenient not to. And
I think the
guy's like, you know, that's my dad, and you're replacing my dad. You know, how are we going to have this compatibility? And he's like, oh, I'm a blank slate. I have no memories. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that makes no sense. Exactly.
Yeah,
like,
no, there'll be no rank. And he's like, what? Okay. That doesn't make any sense. And he's like, and the guy's older. And he's like, well, you're older. You have more memory.
Yeah. How do you have less?
What? You're going to just take off your rank off your shoulder, and that's the same as having this really complicated memory compatibility?
Yeah. That was overall my big beef with the movie. They kind of establish all these rules and, you know, kind of things at the beginning of the movie, and then they kind of systematically get thrown out because it's convenient. You know, it's the classic, like, oh, that plasma cannon takes like a minute to warm up because it's tense when we've got to have some action scenes, except when they need it right now. And then it just fires automatically. Or it's like, yeah, that drift thing. It's like, ooh, we're going to have this big test to see who's compatible with this pilot, because that's really important. Except at the end when anyone can pilot a Jaeger with anyone else. And you're just like, well, come on.
Yeah,
if you're going to build these
just
rules.
Teach that technique.
Yeah,
teach that technique of Zem, just blank your mind. Mm. Then you can take the best pilots together.
Not to excuse it, but you know that's kind of a common trope of anime, though, is to set up the rules of the situation and then allow the main characters to break them.
Yeah, but they're not even like breaking them because they're awesome. It's just like the story treats them as if they were never really important in the first place. And you're like, well, then why did you set that up? It's not like, ooh, we're gonna be drift compatible because I'm just so awesome. It's wait, what? Why do you have no memories? Because that's like. At first, I thought, did he get a mind blank or something? Because we didn't see anything about that at all. And, oh, I would be kind of interesting. Oh, no, we're not going to explore that at all. And it means nothing. It's just a way to hand wave away all the other stuff we've established about having to be drift compatible. So why do I care now?
Can I ask a question, though, about it?
Yeah,
sure.
That drift thing, or that combined memory thing. Sorry, I forgot they called it. But
yeah, drift.
Drift.
Is that something that you could use in a game? Because it sounds pretty interesting.
I thought it had great potential. You know, there's a couple scenes where they're like, I already know what you're thinking. You know, and again, spoiler at the end, kind of the hero guy is supposed to be the reluctant hero because he and his brother were these fantastic drift pilots until during the last fight he did, his brother gets, like, killed while they're connected. And so he has this, like, person kind of inside his head, he says, you know, and, you know, he says, like, you know, I felt my brother's pain, fear, and all the stuff when he died because we were still connected. And you're like, that's kind of awesome, except you then do nothing with it, and it doesn't really matter. So there's all this potential for it to be, like, really cool and do stuff with memories, and they kind of do nothing with it. So
it sounds pretty interesting. Like, I know neither of you guys are big fans of it, and I'm honestly not either, but of the, what was it called? The interim, I think, rules from Savage Worlds, where during the downtime between...
All right.
Action scenes or whatever, you kind of play cards and you tell stories about your past. For that, yeah, it's something like, it sounds like it could be worked in this, you know, kind of sharing memories from your backstory, something like that. I don't know, it sounds like it's got some potential.
Not like that. Mm-hmm. It's you share memories like briefly when you hook up in the movie, like when they kind of.
It's the classic image montage.
They didn't call it the drift handshake. They called it...
Oh, the neural handshake.
Neural handshake. Mm-hmm. So when you hook up to the machine, you have that flooding of memories, but then you're supposed to blank them out so that you concentrate on piloting the Jaeger. Uh-huh.
There's a little
bit... that's where you get that synchronization, is that they do that, and you don't want to... They also have the scene where you get... What happens if you kind of think about these memories or get caught up into it? It's so intense that you're almost catatonic.
It's kind of Inception-y, where you're not supposed to engage with the memories or do anything with them, because if you do, you'll just kind of get lost in them. Uh-huh. And as Lyle said, kind of go catatonic. So for some reason they called it Chasing the Rabbit, maybe like an homage to like Matrix or something. But and again, that they kind of set up the...
Could be Alice in Wonderland.
We are drift compatible because we are able to kind of ignore each other's memories and just let them wash over us, or we're soldiers, so we're kind of trained to like not let that happen.
Uh-huh.
So.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Again, big potential. Kind of wasted.
But you can have like after effects where you remember things about...
Yeah.
The other person... Or yeah, so it allows you to establish a bond in some sort of psychic relationship, I guess.
It's a bit, it almost could be kind of like Dark City, where now I have this other person's memories inside my head. And then someone else has my memories inside their head.
Yeah.
So.
That'd be pretty cool. Yeah, because we've talked before about how difficult it is often to run in a game like where you have a group of players and they're on a vehicle. In this case, it would be a giant robot of sorts. So it might kind of this dual, I don't know, this simultaneous wielding of the body. I don't know. I think you could probably work that into something.
Well, I thought it would be pretty cool, and I was thinking about this, like, have every player play each other's co-pilot, where you have your main pilot that's going to be taking most of the action. Mm-hmm. And it could be kind of messy in a game when you're trying to, have two people run a giant machine. So I would just do it. No, one person is the main pilot, and you're going to make all the roles and make all the decisions. But someone else at the table is going to play your co-pilot, so that there is another person besides you acting as this person, you know, and they'll create them, they'll control them, and they'll kind of be like a secondary character, but not really a main character. So I was thinking, everyone at the table have a primary pilot and a co-pilot.
It would work.
You know?
Pretty well in maybe an online Skype game where not everyone's sitting around the main table, because you could kind of pass instructions to make sure that everybody's coordinating with themselves well enough. Almost kind of like a game of telephone. You have one person who's maybe monitoring the sensors, so you tell them what they see. They have to report it to other people, and then those people have to react. And kind of only the GM would have the overall view of what's going on.
If you did like a giant Voltron thing, yeah. But in like Pacific Rim, like it's those two people, and they can do everything inside the thing where... Like, that's why I would do it just, okay, I'm going to be kind of in charge, just so that we don't butt heads, because that never really happened. It's like, once you're synced and once you're compatible with this person, you pretty much know what your co-pilot is going to do. And that's why having that bond is so important and being compatible is important. So I would just kind of hand wave that and say, nope, you know, player A is the main pilot and they're going to make all the decisions for the Jaeger.
Okay.
Meanwhile, player B has their own, you know, Jaeger somewhere else and their main pilot, but you'll be playing each other's co-pilots just to have, like, a personality to possibly butt up against or to have someone to play off of. But, of course, you'd have to spin it where, like, okay, and the mission is both of the Jaegers are going to go do this, so everyone at the table is involved, you know, in the same capacity.
Hmm. I can see that being a lot of fun.
Yeah, it also could make a very good bad guy, is your ex-co-pilot.
Yeah.
Because they would be able to anticipate your moves.
Yeah, see, again, there's like a lot of stuff that you could explore, because, yeah, that would be an awesome bad guy. And it's a pretty decent explanation as to why they can now figure out you out and second-guess you, because, yeah, they were that close to you.
And playing a giant robot would make for such a great battle scene. Not because just, you know, the fighting, because most games have that, but the setting would be amazing for that. I think about going in a city. Have you ever had to fight in a game where you've had to be extraordinarily delicate of all the things around you?
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
You're not crushing buildings?
That doesn't happen.
Not in the movie, no.
So many people died in that movie that you didn't see. You're just like, well, there goes that building. Yeah, potential.
So much wasted potential.